not every tribe can rely exclusively on casino gaming, and so they have to look to other means of economic development. And typically tribes, other forms of economic development for tribes include tobacco and other vices as well. And so Anna seems like a can fit nicely into that portfolio, as many tribes have been able to turn vices into riches.
Welcome to A Higher Law, a cannabis podcast from the Dykema Law Firm. I'm your host, Cheyenne Benny. For more episodes, you can find us at dykemapodcast.com, youtube.com/dykemalaw, or by searching A Higher Law wherever you get your podcasts. On today's episode, Native Tribes in the Cannabis Market: Is the Reward Worth the Risk? Joining me is Paul Mooney. Paul Mooney is an associate attorney at Dykema here in our Lansing office. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. So can you tell us a little bit about your background working with tribes in the cannabis industry?
Yeah, sure. So I developed a passion for working in Indian country when I was in law school, so much so that I decided to move to a cozy corner of Michigan's Upper Peninsula to work with the Keweenaw Indian community, where I learned that 200 inches of snow is a light winter, but had a great experience working there, and I helped out on their cannabis matters. And afterwards, I went and worked a brief period of time at the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe in Pleasant, Michigan, where I also worked on related matters for the tribe before coming on board here at Dykema.
Very cool. So many of our listeners may be unaware of what federal Indian law is. Can you give an overview of how the law treats Native American tribes?
I'm just going to tell a quick story about my experience with the Keweenaw Bay Indian community to help contextualize the novel legal issues tribes can face entering the marijuana market. So the Keweenaw Bay Indian community is a federally recognized Indian tribe located along the Keweenaw Bay in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. The tribal council is the primary government body for the tribe. Marijuana was of interest to the tribe as a new means of economic development. So there are many parallels between casino gaming as a means of generating revenue, given the risky nature of the business venture. And many council members see marijuana as a safer alternative to opioids and other prescription pain medications. So the tribe was actively looking for a way to enter the cannabis market. One day, an entrepreneur attended a tribal council meeting to discuss selling a marijuana grow facility to the tribe. The state of Michigan and the local township provided licenses to the entrepreneur to operate a medical marijuana facility in a decommissioned military installation, which the Navy had operated until 2004. The entrepreneur bought the facility and turned it into a marijuana grow. The entrepreneur was looking to sell the facility and was asking for over $3 million. And he needed to know at that meeting if the tribe was interested in moving forward, as the entrepreneur was looking to sell the facility relatively quickly. So the tribe ultimately decided not to move forward with the purchase, but in exploring the option, there were a number of legal issues the tribe would have had to work through in order to determine what to actually buy the facility. So a state license was required to operate the facility, as the facility was outside of the tribe's jurisdiction or off reservation. So would state law allow the entrepreneur to transfer his license to the tribe? The state and federal government provided much of the tribe's funding. So what funds could the tribe use to purchase the facility? The tribe would be entering a competitive marketplace. So does the tribe have any competitive advantages allowing it to stay in business? And so these were a number of legal issues the tribe was faced in order to enter the cannabis market. And their tribe had to sort through all of these legal issues in order to move forward. And these are the types of issues that all tribes are facing, whether or not they want to operate a cannabis facility on their own reservation, under their jurisdiction, or if they want to go operate under state law. And so these are ubiquitous issues in Indian country.
Yeah, and it's not just the cannabis industry. You know, there's federal Indian law, and many of our listeners might not even know what federal Indian law is. Can you give kind of an overview of how the law treats Native Americans?
Yeah, sure. So tribes are considered domestic dependent nations, which is something between a foreign nation and a state. The main implication of this is that tribes are generally free to create rules for the government, if day-to-day government operations, as well as tribal members, regardless of what state law is and arguably what federal law is. Tribes, like other governments, need revenue in order to support government services. It's traditional tools that governments use to raise revenue for themselves, namely taxes, are not generally unavailable to tribes. Many tribes have a small group of members that they could collect tax revenue from, and generally these are the efforts to tax revenue from its membership base are largely going to be unsuccessful due to the economic position of many tribal members throughout the country. And so what tribes need to do in order to raise revenue for their government services is to turn to economic development, which is another way of saying tribal businesses. And so the most common form of economic development is casino gaming. More than half of all tribes have a casino gaming operation, but most of the casino revenue benefits a small number of tribes that have access to a large urban center or a large casino market. So not every tribe can rely exclusively on casino gaming in order to raise revenue for services. So they have to look at other means of economic development. Most tribal economic development generally involves running a business to generate revenue. So, and tribal businesses are similar to other businesses, but they are unique in how they are organized. So, for example, some tribes can just run the business through the government, where the tribal council votes on decisions for the business just as it would any other under its own constitution as the main governing charter. Sometimes other tribes create sub-government entities. They might incorporate tribal or state LLCs. But the main details takeaway is that tribal businesses, although they may operate similarly to other businesses, they generally, the tribal government is usually involved with the business in one way, shape, or form.
So it seems odd that tribes are getting into cannabis, as so many of them seem to be operating the casinos. I would imagine that those casinos are a large source of their revenue there. Can you explain why tribes are getting into cannabis?
Yeah, so casino gaming is the most common form of economic development in Indian country. It's the primary means that the most common form of economic development for tribes. But the story of casino gaming in Indian country is a story of haves and have-nots. So most of the casino revenue benefits a small number of tribes that have access to a large urban center. So not every tribe can rely exclusively on casino gaming, and so they have to look to other means of economic development. And typically tribes, other forms of economic development for tribes include tobacco and other vices as well. And so Anna seems like a can fit nicely into that portfolio, as many tribes have been able to turn vices into riches. And so that, in addition to, as other tribes enter into the space, other tribal members and tribes are excited to see that. And so it can create a log roll type of effect.
What are some of the challenges that these tribes are facing when they're operating marijuana businesses?
The largest issue that tribes are facing is interacting with the state market. So state laws usually do not matter that much for tribal businesses, since tribes are generally exempt from state regulation in Indian country. However, marijuana is unique, as many tribes will want to interact with other state licensed companies, but will be precluded from doing so, as state licensing laws generally do not consider tribes. For example, let's suppose a tribe has legalized marijuana on its reservation and starts a marijuana grow operation. It is located in a remote area, so it plans on selling its product off reservation, since it does not have an excellent location for a retail store. So the tribe will need to consider whether it can sell to non-tribal businesses off its reservation. State marijuana laws vary, but state laws generally require a business to require a license from a state agency and possibly the local municipality. The state can still prosecute an individual for selling marijuana without a license. So if a tribe attempts to sell marijuana to a state-licensed retailer without a state license, they likely are not protected from state criminal prosecution. A state-licensed retailer could also face prosecution if it purchased from a tribal marijuana facility with no license. One resolution is if the tribe received a license from the state. but state law may preclude a tribe from qualifying for a license due to the state's background check requirements and the state's definition of who can be an applicant for a state license. So to provide an example, the Keweenaw Bay Indian community was initially advised that, the Cannabis Regulatory Agency initially advised that because the if the tribe wanted to receive a license, then all of its members would need to go through the background check requirements. And given that the Keweenaw Bay Indian community had over 2,000 members, it was impractical for the tribe to go through the licensing process for the state. If a tribe attempts to sell marijuana to a state licensed retailer without a state license, they likely are not protected from state criminal prosecution. A state licensed retailer could also face prosecution if it purchased from a tribal marijuana retail facility with no license. The tribe could limit itself to operating on its reservation, but this may not be practical as the tribe will have a limited market and will need financial resources to provide everything on its own. So there are two means for the tribe to resolve these issues other than conducting everything on the reservation. The first option is compacting, which is an agreement between the tribe and the state on handling a particular legal issue. The tribe and the state would agree to recognize each other's licenses. And in exchange, the tribe will agree to enforce certain state provisions itself. So Nevada and Washington State have entered into compacts with tribes regarding marijuana. Compacting can be a controversial issue, a topic in Indian country, one, because tribes view it as a limitation of their sovereignty. In a sense, they are agreeing with the state that they'll enact or enforce certain state laws rather than allowing future tribal councils or future legislatures to make those decisions themselves. And so it can be controversial for many tribes to want to enter into compacts with states whom they've often had very tenuous or tough relationships with. But the one advantage of compacting is that it is simultaneously, it's a familiar process to tribes in the gaming context. And tribes can still, despite the limitations on a tribe's sovereignty, they're still able to regulate the facilities on their own reservation themselves, regardless of the limitations that the compact may impose. Tribes can also, as I mentioned as well, can try to work through the state system in order to receive a license, and then they can operate under state law, although that can pose some challenges if the state is unwilling to budge or change its licensing laws. Another issue tribes can face is typically interacting with federal regulations on tribal that impact a tribe's land. So land issues are less frequent for tribes, although they can come up because a tribe is generally free to use land and trust and fee land it owns on its reservation as it sees fit. However, Indian land can create issues for leasing to non-members and having land taken into trust. So tribes may wish to put a marijuana operation located on fee land in trust, which will allow the tribe to exercise jurisdiction over the operation. So let's suppose that the Keweenaw Bay Indian community had bought the facility that is off reservation. What it can do is it can go through a federal process, which is called the fee to trust process, where essentially the United States takes title to the land and holds it in benefit of the tribe. When that happens, the tribe is generally free to exercise jurisdiction over that parcel of land. So although when it's off reservation and it's not in trust, it's not considered Indian country, and the tribe couldn't exercise its own jurisdiction over that facility, it would have to follow state law exclusively. In contrast, if the land is put into trust and even though it's off the tribe's reservation, the tribe could exercise its own jurisdiction over that parcel of land, and the state generally would be precluded from requiring the tribe to follow state licensing laws over that parcel of property, although there are important exceptions and ways that the state can exercise its sovereignty regardless. But the takeaway is that if the tribe was able to put that land into trust, it would have far more authority to make decisions about how the facility is regulated. So the problem with putting that land into trust in that context is that the Department of Interior will have to inspect the land. So the DOI will know that the tribe is using the land for a marijuana operation, and they have a lot of discretion in whether or not to take the land into trust. So it likely will decline to do so if the land's use violates federal law. An alternative is if the tribe puts land into trust first and then builds a marijuana operation, but this is at least will delay the start of the business because due to the length of the fee to trust process, which can very easily take 6 months to a year. Some tribes may simply wish to lease land to non-members and collect a portion of the profits. So a few tribes in Michigan are doing just that. Leasing has the same issues as getting land into trust, because the Department of Interior may not approve the lease if marijuana is involved. There is a workaround, as the Hearth Act under federal law allows tribes to adopt their own rules and approve leases. So generally, leases on trust land need federal approval, but the two workarounds, the Hearth Act, the tribe itself can just approve the lease. It does not need to go to the Department of Interior. The second one is a little bit more convoluted, but an alternative is if the Department of Interior does not need to approve a sublease. So in theory, if you have a lease already approved and decide to sublease it to a cannabis operator, then that lease will not need to be approved. So there are some options to partner with non-members on land and trust, but not great options to get land into trust where a tribe is already or plans to cultivate marijuana.
So, Paul, do these tribes have any kind of advantages?
Yeah, sure. So despite a lot of the challenges that I've outlined, tribes do have unique abilities to enter the marijuana market. First, the tribe's ability to exercise their sovereignty without state interference could allow a lot of flexibility for structuring their marijuana businesses. So as I mentioned, tribes are domestic dependent nations and are generally free to create their own rules and are ruled by them in Indian country. So tribes are free to regulate their businesses in their jurisdiction. The state could not come in and argue that it has jurisdiction over the tribe, even over illegal activity. There have been a few circumstances where the state has jurisdiction over the tribe, but usually a federal statute is involved that explicitly grants the state jurisdiction. Tribes could develop their own laws regarding marijuana, which could allow for some creativity and flexibility in the types of businesses created. State laws generally have fixed license types, so the grow, retailer, all the different types and the number of different regulations and rules that apply to each license type. And the tribe won't have to abide by that if it's regulating its own facilities. So one challenge to tribal sovereignty is the tribes' internal procedures themselves. So many tribal constitutions still contain provisions that require the Department of Interior to approve tribal ordinances. The tribe's first step in exercising its sovereignty is passing laws regarding marijuana within its jurisdiction. The Department of Interior is unlikely to approve of a marijuana ordinance due to its criminality under federal law. So tribes will need to find workarounds or amend their constitutions. Another advantage the tribes have is in their treatment under federal tax laws. So marijuana businesses must pay federal income tax like other businesses, despite federal laws criminalizing this activity. The tax code treats marijuana businesses harsher than legal businesses. So Congress enacted Section 280E of the tax code, which generally prevents businesses that traffic a controlled substance from deducting ordinary and necessary business income. In contrast, Congress generally has not chosen to impose federal income taxes on tribes as a means of supporting tribal sovereignty. So tribal businesses generally do not pay federal income tax on or off the reservation. So tribes generally have a tax advantage compared to other businesses, but this advantage is even more significant in the marijuana context, given the tax code's harsh treatment of marijuana businesses. This advantage will largely impact retailers rather than growers, because growers can still deduct their cost of goods sold, which helps reduce this disparity. This advantage for tribes is fairly tremendous. So one scholar recently calculated the impact of this tax advantage. Assuming the same revenue and expenses for a tribal and non-tribal retailer, the tribal company has nearly double the profit from the non-tribal business just based on the tribe's tax exempt status alone. Wow. So for example, if a tribal business, assuming the same amount of revenue for a tribal business compared to a non-tribal business, the non-tribal business would have about, you know, assuming they had $10 million, for instance, the non-tribal business would have about $770,000 in profit, whereas the tribal business would have $1.4 million. So it ends up being a pretty significant advantage. The issue with this, or the thing that tribes will have to work through, is the tax court has found that tribes will need to organize in a certain fashion to be exempt from federal taxation. If a tribe incorporates as a state chartered corporation, it is unlikely to receive this tax exemption. So a tribal business could charter a separate government entity or use certain federal corporations to avoid federal income tax. Tribes especially need to consider entity formation when seeking a state license. So actually, the fact that tribes do not have to pay federal income tax definitely interacts with the state licensing requirements I was speaking about earlier. So if the state would not allow the tribe to receive a license unless it incorporates under state law, or if the business is not wholly owned by the tribe, then the tribe advantage is gone. And so how the tribe decides to enter under state law, that will need to be mindful of how they organize their business in order to take advantage of this. And this also can create some issues with partnering with non-tribal entities, so, or non-tribal businesses. So oftentimes a tribe might have to work with a partner organization, you know, to bring some of the cannabis expertise into operating the business. And so oftentimes the manager or the non-tribal business will want to have an ownership interest in the company in order to, you know, reap the rewards of the business that they're creating. If this were to occur, then the tribe's this benefit would be gone. So if it's a tribal business where 90% of it is owned by the tribe and 10% is not owned by the tribe, would be shocked to find a tax court that could say the tribe is exempt from, or this business is exempt from, federal income tax. So how the tribe and the non-tribal partner in those circumstances will have to work out creative ways of ensuring that the non-tribal partner is compensated. And so this is a fairly significant advantage and is a great reason for a great opportunity for partnerships between tribal and non-tribal entities.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of the tribes in Michigan doing?
So there are three models that tribes have created in the last few years in Michigan. The first model is what I was outlining earlier in terms of exercising tribal sovereignty, where a tribe is regulating a tribally owned business on its own reservation, enacts its own ordinance and its own rules and regulations, and those apply to the tribal business, and everything is operated exclusive of state law. So for the time being, under Michigan law, tribal business, under this model, the tribal business would not be able to interact with state licensees. And so they would have to, are not only confined to their reservation, but would have to provide all the aspects of a tribal, of a cannabis operation themselves, which includes the growing, processing, selling, and all the other components. The other model is there is a tribe that has actually successfully received a state license through a nonprofit company that is incorporated under tribal law. And so this model is the opposite, where the entity is fully regulated by the state of Michigan. It just happens to be owned by a tribal investor or a tribe. The third model actually uses some of the leasing and land. Involves the tribe leasing property to a non-tribal business, and in exchange, the tribe receives rental payments or is taken in as a part owner of the business. So, how this materialized is that there have been a couple areas in the state of Michigan where the local municipality had decided it did not want to opt into cannabis. And so a retailer wasn't unable to, or any other cannabis business wasn't able to set up in that municipality. But instead, what they did was the Cannabis Regulatory Agency found it acceptable for the local, the non-tribal business to partner with the tribe in the area. And so the business was allowed to, how the setup works is the tribe, as I mentioned, leases land that is under the tribe's jurisdiction to the non-tribal business. And the tribe also provides a sovereign waiver in favor of the state of Michigan to come out and regulate the non-tribal business. So state law applies to this business and is regulated as any other state company, but it's still operating within a tribe's jurisdiction. And essentially the municipality is not, despite the fact that the municipality is has not enacted an ordinance, this allows, the CRA has determined that this allows the non-tribal business to operate in this space. And so it provides some advantages to a tribe if they're interested in simply getting involved with the cannabis space, but they're not directly operating or managing a facility. And so they're, it allows them to create an early partnership.
All right. Is there anything else that you want to touch on? Anything else that you want to tell our listeners?
No, just that tribes face a number of legal issues in terms of entering the market. Really, the state laws are really not written with tribes in mind. And so with that, there's a number of legal issues that tribes will have to work through in order to enter the space. However, there are pretty significant advantages that tribes can exercise and can compete in this marketplace. I will note as well that the state of Michigan is considering legislation that would empower the Cannabis Regulatory Agency and the Department of Treasury to compact with tribes, which would help resolve a number of these state policy issues.
Oh, really? Okay. Did not know that. Well, that is it for us today. Thank you for listening. Thank you all for being here. It's been a very educational and informative episode here. As always, you can find us at dykemapodcast.com, youtube.com/dykemalaw, or by searching A Higher Law wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Cheyenne Benny, and we look forward to seeing you next time on A Higher Law.